Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics, Iowa style, and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, broadcasting again tonight from Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and joined as always through the magic of electronics by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Leading Heartland. Good to be with you again, Laura, and I hope you had a great Thanksgiving week.
Yes, I did. Hope everyone out there did as well.
You bet. Well, we do not have a turkey of a show tonight. We have plenty to talk about over the next half hour. And we're going to begin with the topic we have led with, unfortunately, all too often this past year, the coronavirus. A judge today, Monday, blocked the federal government from enforcing a coronavirus vaccine mandate for healthcare workers in Iowa and nine other states. Laura, this is a big deal, and it affects a lot of people in Iowa.
Yes, it does. So this affects the mandate for people who are employed at hospitals and healthcare facilities. Mainly, that would include nursing homes. Now, most of the large hospital groups in Iowa already are mandating COVID-19 vaccines for their staff, but most nursing homes are not doing that. So this is one of three lawsuits Governor Reynolds has joined that are challenging the Biden administration's vaccine mandates. And the other ones have not been heard yet by federal judges, but they deal with mandates for large employers and federal contractors. But this one, it's very important because, as we've talked about, a lot of the hospitalizations and severe illness, most of that is concentrated in the unvaccinated population. But of the people who are vaccinated who are becoming severely ill, many of them are nursing home residents who, either because of advanced age or other underlying health conditions, don't have as strong an immunoresponse even after being fully vaccinated. So the fact that staff at these nursing homes will be able to remain unvaccinated for the foreseeable future, as this Biden administration policy has been enjoined, that's a big deal. We have dozens of nursing homes right now dealing with outbreaks in Iowa.
And to confirm what you've just said, the number of people hospitalized with the coronavirus just keeps going up in Iowa. The State Department of Health reporting Monday afternoon that 665 patients now hospitalized with the virus, up from 616 last Friday. 75% of those hospitalized are not vaccinated. The state also reporting last week that 86 more people had died from the virus, bringing to 7,354 the total number of people who have died from it since the pandemic started. So the numbers just keep showing up in a very bad way in Iowa.
Yes, and the hospitalization numbers have been hovering in the 500s or the 600s now for a couple of months, and that's really quite high. It's higher than at any point since about January of this year, and it's just hovering and sometimes going up, some weeks going down a little bit, but it's at a very high level. And although it's not close to the absolute record that we had last November, where we had more than 1,500 patients at one point hospitalized with a coronavirus, what I'm hearing from healthcare workers is that this level of 600 and some hospitalized with COVID-19 is not sustainable for hospital groups. There are a lot of patients who normally would be transferred to an ICU for other conditions, heart attack, stroke, broken hip, and there aren't ICU beds for them because the COVID patients, not only are they taking up a lot of beds, but they have very long hospital stays, especially the ones who are on ventilators. They are often hospitalized for weeks. And so that use of ICU resources is really very serious, and it's something that our hospitals are not dealing with that easily right now.
And another troubling number is that the state's positivity rate was reported on Monday to be 10.8%. That's up from 10.5% on Friday. That number indicates that there are a significant number of people, more people, who are testing positive. Whether we have the absolute numbers, because we don't know how many people are testing, but we know that the percentage keeps going up.
Yes, generally speaking, the higher the positivity rate is, and 10% or more is quite high, that's a sign that you're not testing enough people and that there are a lot of cases out there you're missing. So community transmission across the state of Iowa is very high right now. The CDC is recommending that people, regardless of their vaccination status, that people wear masks when they're indoors in public spaces and try to keep their social distance, and of course get vaccinated, or if they're more than 6 months out from their vaccinations, to get a booster shot, which is now all adults are eligible for those booster shots.
And what doctors are also saying is that they're really worried because of the rise in cases of the coronavirus, and also coupled with a spike in flu cases. And they're saying we really need to take some more precautions that a lot of people are not taking. We know that 54% of Iowans are fully vaccinated. That means 40%, 46% are not. And now, on top of all that, here comes another new virus variant called Omicron. And this one has the potential to be, well, bad.
Yes. I mean, the data are not in yet on how whether this Omicron variant causes more severe illness or not. It does appear to be more transmissible than Delta, but everything I've been reading says we need at least 2 to 3 more weeks to get some data on how severe the illness is. The hospitalizations and deaths always lag the new cases. And one thing that people are concerned about is that we just had so many people gathering with extended family or friends over Thanksgiving, and there could have been a lot of virus transmission. Those people would only just be falling ill this week. And if they become severely ill enough to be hospitalized, that probably wouldn't happen until sometime next week. So we could be seeing a post-Thanksgiving surge. And then again, that's before this new variant. We don't know. We don't have any confirmed cases yet in the United States, but it's thought that it probably is here. Most European countries, once they start looking for it, they're finding it. Canada has already found it. So it's a safe bet that it is probably already circulating. But we don't know yet whether it's going to outcompete the Delta variant. And we don't know whether it causes more severe illness than the Delta variant.
Right. And one of the things doctors are looking at is this new variant Omicron, is it a virulent spreader or is it a virulent illness maker? Because the two may not go together, and they likely don't. If it creates more serious illness, that actually works against its fast spread because it tends to put it bluntly, kill off the people it infects.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, Delta became so dominant because it is such a fast spreader. If you remember in the spring, we were talking about the Alpha variant, and that hit a lot of states really hard. It didn't hit Iowa as hard as it did some other states, but the Delta variant overtook the Alpha variant just within a span of 2 or 3 months. And I saw some troubling numbers from the state of Michigan. Michigan was one of the hardest hit by the Alpha variant. And some people thought, well, maybe they have very high rates in their population of infection acquired immunity. And so maybe the Delta variant's not going to be so bad there, but they are having some of their highest case numbers that they've seen at any point in the pandemic. So unfortunately, whatever happened in the spring with Alpha causing so many problems in Michigan does not seem to have made them less vulnerable to Delta. And that's what makes people so worried as this new variant is probably going to be hitting us. What's going to happen, especially in that unvaccinated population?
Meanwhile, while all this is going on, Mercy One confirmed last week in Iowa that children who received their vaccination shots at a mass vaccination clinic at Urbandale a couple of weekends ago, they got the wrong dose. Yep, they received double the correct dose for children, still less than the adult dose. Now, they say there are some side effects of this, not necessarily serious, but this is not a very good move in terms of encouraging people to get vaccinated, is it?
No. Oh, and I mean, I think if anyone who is on the fence about having their kids vaccinated, it's unfortunate whenever a story like that is in the news. And I always would recommend to anybody, whether they're an adult or a parent of a minor, to always double check and make sure that you're getting the right dose, or your child is getting the right dose. I mean, it's unfortunately these mistakes do happen. They are pretty rare. But when you have hundreds of thousands of people getting vaccinated, it's not surprising that there's going to be a mishap somewhere. I don't believe that any of the children became severely ill. I think there were more side effects in terms of soreness and fever and some of the other issues.
Right. A couple of more notes on the coronavirus. Word last week that employees at Wells Fargo and Company are soon going to have to prove they're vaccinated against the coronavirus or agree to regular testing. So they are really going to be cracking down on the coronavirus in that company.
Yes. And the regular testing is an option for people who prefer not to get vaccinated. But I think what they found in some of the other large corporations that have done this is that most people don't want to go through the hassle of getting tested every week. And so eventually a lot of people who were reluctant to get vaccinated do end up getting the shot. So we'll see. The Wells Fargo is implementing this pretty quickly here or in December. So I guess we'll find out fairly soon how it's going. It's a major employer in central Iowa, obviously.
Right. It has about 13,000 people in central Iowa, 13,000 workers. Meanwhile, Governor Reynolds made some news last week saying she is confident that her use of $450,000 in federal coronavirus relief money is going to be approved by the U.S. Treasury. She's responding now to an audit by Rob Sand that was generated by a report by someone I work with periodically. That would be you on Monday nights here. You broke that story a long time ago. So what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, the governor said she's confident that the Treasury Department is going to approve this, but the Treasury Department's Deputy Inspector General, Richard Delmar, told me a couple of weeks ago that his agency is not auditing this. This is something that the governor's office has to work out with the state auditor's office. And that, and I circled back to confirm with him, you mean that any documentation they have needs to be submitted to state auditors? And he said, that is correct. So when she says she's confident the federal government is going to approve it, I'm really not sure what she means by that, because the federal government right now, the Treasury Department, is not looking directly at this. It's something they may audit next year, but the state auditor, Rob Sand, has advised the governor to return this money before December 31st so that it can be put to a use that is unquestionable. There's just no doubt that it would fall within the CARES Act standard of being a necessary expenditure incurred due to the pandemic. And right now, I mean, the state auditors have told me they have not received, when they asked during their investigation, when they asked twice the governor's office for documentation supporting this use of funds on her staff salaries, nothing was provided from the governor's office. And one thing that I've always found strange, and I wasn't at the event last week, so I wasn't able to ask the governor this myself, but there was one staffer in her office, Paul Trombino, who was her chief operating officer, who was very deeply involved in the pandemic response, and yet she did not use CARES Act funds to pay his salary. His salary was pushed onto another agency, the Department of Administrative Services. So it really raises the question, was this about using CARES Act funds for the people who were involved in the pandemic work, or was it just about using CARES Act funds to cover the salaries that weren't being covered by other agencies and where there wasn't a sufficient budget appropriation for the governor's office? Because the documents that I received, and that ended up, some of them ended up in the state audit, indicated that the way they arrived at this figure was working out how much of a budget shortfall the governor's office had and how much they needed to tap from the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Relief Fund, to make sure that the budget was balanced at the end of that fiscal year 2020. And I should add that for the fiscal year 2021, that's the year that just ended on June 30th, the governor did not use any coronavirus relief funds to pay her staff salaries. Instead, she pushed about $800,000 of her staff salaries onto other state agencies.
I'm pretty sure you're going to continue following this story for us on Capital Week, Laura.
Oh, yes. The governor's office budget has been one of my issues for years.
Yes. One more note on the governor, and she made news on Monday afternoon. Not surprising news. She says that the U.S. Supreme Court this week has she's calling the best opportunity yet to overturn landmark abortion protection rulings when the court hears arguments this week in a Mississippi case. This is one that she and other governors and other people have been looking forward to try to chip away at Roe v. Wade, the law that gives women the right to abortion. So this is the first step, perhaps, in their mind.
Yes, this is a law that many people in the anti-abortion movement have been looking at for years as an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade. As people may remember that in 2018, the Iowa legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that banned almost all abortions in Iowa after about the 6-week mark, whatever a fetal heartbeat could be detected. And that law was struck down by a Polk County District Court, and the governor did not end up appealing to the Iowa Supreme Court. It was thought that she might try to use that law as a test case that could eventually be appealed in federal courts and get all the way up to the Supreme Court. But she opted not to appeal, and it was thought that in the movement, they believed that other states had laws that would make better test cases, and this was one for Mississippi. So this is a law that basically would ban any abortions going back past the 15-week mark, so before viability. And currently, the U.S. Supreme Court precedent under the Casey ruling from 1992 says that the states are not supposed to ban abortions before the date of viability, and they're also not supposed to put undue burdens in front of women who are seeking abortion. So there are any number of ways that the U.S. Supreme Court could deal with this. They do seem to have the votes to overturn Roe v. Wade. But I was reading an article today in Vox by their Supreme Court correspondent, Ian Millhiser, and he was talking about how the Supreme Court could, in effect, eviscerate Roe v. Wade without formally overruling the precedent. So they could leave the precedent in place, but they could say, for instance, that abortion providers don't have standing to challenge laws like this. They could say that only individual women have standing to challenge the laws. They could also leave the skeleton of the Roe v. Wade framework intact, but then they could just change what they consider an undue burden on women. So there are any number of ways they can deal with it. Of course, the governor is hoping that they eliminate the precedent from 1973 altogether, and then the Republican-controlled legislature would be very likely just to pass another law similar to what was passed in 2018 that would be almost a total ban on abortions in the state of Iowa.
It is 16 after the hour, wherever you are listening to us, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin, and we are here every week at this time, every single week, to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Let's move on. There is word that the strike against the John Deere Company in Iowa and other states did not keep the company from posting record profits. The company earned more than $1 billion from August through October of this year. Part of that time was during the strike. So, Laura, we know that the workers got a 10% pay hike plus some additional hikes. Is it possible that they could have gotten more had they held out?
Well, it's a complicated question. Deere announced last week that, first of all, they announced that they're giving their salaried employees, that's the non-United Auto Workers members, they're giving them an 8% raise effective November 1st. And as you mentioned, the union workers are getting an immediate 10% raise. They're getting an $8,500 ratification bonus and some other benefits. And the total cost of that is probably going to be in the $250 million to $300 million range. But that's only about 4 to 5% of the profits they got just in last year alone. The company reported nearly $6 billion in profit, and they're actually projecting an even larger profit for the fiscal year that just began, the 2022 fiscal year. Part of that is they think that their crop prices are going to increase demand for farm equipment. And part of it is the bipartisan infrastructure bill that President Biden signed earlier this month, which they believe is going to lead to a lot of purchase orders for the construction equipment that Deere manufactures. So I think there's no question that Deere could have afforded to give the UAW members more. The question is, had the union voted down that agreement, would the company have come back with a better offer? Because it's possible that they could have taken the position that the union was not negotiating in good faith, and nothing requires the company to be at the bargaining table, much less agree to any of the union's demands. And as we're seeing with the Kellogg strike, which is affecting a lot of thousands of people at mostly in other states, not Iowa, but the company is trying to bring in strike breakers rather than sitting down and making a better offer to the union in that case. So there's really no guarantee. I mean, Deere kept saying this is our last, best, and final offer, and we'll never know whether it really was their last, best, and final offer. It's clear, I think, that the company could have shared a bit more of the profits than they did.
Right. But as you say, we will indeed not know. All right. Word on this Monday afternoon that State Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer is going to move from Ankeny and seek re-election in a new, more conservative district. So let's download all of this. Why is this happening?
So Republicans in general in Iowa, the political trends have moved Republicans' way over the last 10 or 15 years. But one area where they have lost ground is in the suburban precincts, the suburbs. This is in Iowa, as in many states across the country. Voters in the suburbs are tending to vote more for Democrats in the past. And Jack Whitfer, when he was up for re-election in 2014, he didn't even have an opponent. That's how heavily Republican his district was. In 2018, he faced Amber Gustafson, and she really gave him all that they could handle. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on that race. And I can tell you that shortly before the 2018 election, Republicans were genuinely worried worried that Jack Whitaker was going to lose his seat. He ended up winning by about 1,000 votes. But the new district is a little bit more compact. Ankeny has grown, of course, substantially over the last decade. And so the new district doesn't include some outlying areas of Polk County that used to be part of his district. It's just suburban precincts. And this is a district that Joe Biden carried in the 2020 presidential election. So I think it's very telling that even though a midterm is usually a good election for the party out of power, that Jack Whitaker decided he does not want to seek re-election in a suburban district, even in a midterm year that looks like it might be good for Republicans. So he is moving to a district that includes much of northern and eastern Polk County, but outside of the city of Des Moines and most of the suburbs of Des Moines. So it includes a few other areas like Grimes, some areas in the eastern part of the county, but it's really quite a bit more Republican than the district that he's fleeing.
And he is going to have to move, but not necessarily too soon, because the law is that lawmakers, state lawmakers, have to live in their district at least 60 days prior to the general election.
And he doesn't have to move very far. I mean, you really don't have to go far outside of Ankeny. I don't know what his plans are, but he could just go a few miles outside the Ankeny, outside his current address, and just be barely outside the Ankeny city limits and be part of this new district, Senate District 23. The one that he's leaving is going to be called Senate District 21. So I should say also that he does have a declared opponent of the there has been a Democrat actively campaigning for a few months in this District 21. Jack Whitaker is leading, and it's a guy named Todd Brady. He is better known to many as the Iowa Vaccine Hunter because he created a website called Vaccine Hunter that a lot of people use to find appointments. In fact, I used it to find an appointment for one of my children. But this is something he is running on, competency in government and criticizing the COVID-19 response of state government. And I think it is interesting that Jack Whitaker didn't fancy a campaign against Todd Brady in this district. That we don't know whether the trends will continue, but it has been trending to become a much more competitive district than compared to the solid Republican turf that the suburbs once were.
And there was some sad news in politics last week in Iowa. Democrat Dave Muhlbauer ended his U.S. Senate campaign. He was going to run for the Democratic nomination against Chuck Grassley, but he had to drop out for, unfortunately, a very sad reason, Laura.
Yes. The Muhlbauers, they're a farming family in Crawford County, and he farms with relatives. And unfortunately, his four-year-old nephew died in a tragic farm accident in August. And Muhlbauer had not really actively campaigned since that time. He missed a lot of events that the other Senate candidates were at. And so there was a lot of speculation about whether he would end his campaign. And he just said right before Thanksgiving that this was just so devastating for his family, and he really needs to take time to be with his family. And he said he appreciated the support and encouragement that he had gotten from Democrats, but this just isn't the right thing. This campaign is not the right thing for his family now. So it's just every parent's worst nightmare. And these are people he worked very closely with. And so just my heart went out to the Muhlbauer family and the Rieselman family. That was the name of the child who passed away. And so there are several other candidates running for Senate still on the Democratic side. But Dave Muhlbauer, who was running a rural focused campaign, saying he was an old fashioned farming labor Democrat, he is not going to be bringing his voice to that primary next spring.
And as you say, there are other candidates running on the Democratic side for that nomination. A couple of them are what we would call heavyweights. Why don't we talk briefly about them?
Yeah, so the front runner is Abby Finkenauer. She is the former U.S. representative. She served for one term covering most of Northeast Iowa. She has a lot of endorsements. She raised more than $1 million already in her first quarter in the race. Then we have retired Vice Admiral Mike Franken, who was the runner-up in the 2020 Senate primary. He just announced this fall, so he hasn't reported any fundraising numbers. People are going to be very closely watching to see if he can raise enough money to run a statewide campaign. The other two Democrats who have declared, Glenn Hurst, he's a family physician in Southwest Iowa, and Bob Krause, who is a veterans advocate, served in the state legislature for a few terms in the 1970s, but they so far haven't raised a lot of money. I don't think they've hired a lot of staff. And so it looks like the primary is shaping up to be mostly a competition between Abby Finkenauer and Mike Franken.
And Senator Grassley has a Republican opponent in the primary, but honestly, that opponent probably won't give him a lot of trouble, will he?
No, I don't think so. It's State Senator Jim Carlin. He's running as the more Trump-supporting alternative. He calls Chuck Grassley a more moderate Mitch McConnell Republican, and he says that he's a Donald Trump Republican. He's one of the most out there social conservatives. He was a leading voice in the Iowa Senate for a transgender bathroom bill that didn't advance. He actually voted against the vaccine passport bill. He didn't think it went far enough. He's been critical of, he just thinks that the state, basically any coronavirus mitigation measure, he's been critical of, and he's been critical of the vaccines as well. So I don't think that there's any danger that Chuck Grassley will lose the primary, but I will be watching closely to see what kind of a vote Jim Carlin gets, because it certainly could be in the 20 to 30 range. I mean, I just don't know. We'll find out how large is that contingent within the Republican Party of Iowa who thinks that Chuck Grassley is too moderate and too compromising. There were a lot of people very unhappy that Grassley voted for that infrastructure bill.
Right. We have about 3 minutes left. There was a report last week that Iowa regulators had agreed to keep secret the names of thousands of individual landowners in the path of Summit Carbon Solutions' proposed carbon capture pipeline. This is a controversial pipeline, another controversial pipeline. This was an interesting decision.
Yeah, so there was a split decision on the Iowa Utilities Board, which has three members. So the two Republican members agreed that they should keep the names of the landowners secret. And it's important. The environmental activists and other opponents of this pipeline were hoping to use those addresses to try to reach out to people who may not be aware that they're on the pipeline's path and try to bring them into efforts to defeat this thing, the Sierra Club, among others. Jerry Huser, who is the Democrat serving on that board, her position was that they should keep the name secret, but they should publish the addresses so that at least people could send, they could send a letter, let's say, to a homeowner or resident, and again, inform people that there are efforts to defeat this pipeline and that their land is in danger, that there could be eminent domain used to seize their land. So it's a controversial decision. I think that the openness advocates, the public information advocates, didn't agree with the position. Jerry Huser said that Iowa's open records law says that they should try to release as much information as they can. And clearly in this situation, they didn't release as much as they could have.
Less than two to go, a Northeast Iowa company that first sought to export billions of gallons of groundwater to parched Western states abandoned that request altogether last week, the Pattison Sand Company proposal. Let's talk about that.
Yes, this was good reporting by Jared Strong of Iowa Capital Dispatch. I had lost track of this case. This was the Pattison Sand Company, and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources had rejected their idea because state law requires that you have to show that you're putting water resources to some beneficial use. And there was no evidence that anything about this plan of exporting billions of gallons of water, that they wasn't going to benefit Iowans in any way. And this aquifer that they were going to tap, I mean, this is a really huge, the Jordan Aquifer really supplies a lot of water for a lot of Iowans. So it was surprising. I mean, most people don't think of the Department of Natural Resources as taking a very hard line on protecting the environment, but this was one case where they did. And so last week, like I said, Jared Strong reported that this company, the Pattison Sand Company, said that they were just not going to request that. They had tried to scale back their requests, but they just decided that this is not going to go anywhere. And again, the Sierra Club was involved in fighting this. They thought it was putting the whole Jordan Aquifer at risk, and they feel that already demand on the aquifer is unsustainable, that cities have been taking more out of it than is going into it for quite a while.
Less than 30 seconds. We're going to hear some more announcements, aren't we, coming up about lawmakers moving to different districts in order to survive the redistricting process.
Yes. And in the Iowa Senate, people have to declare by February of next year. They have to declare whether they're retiring or moving or what's happening. What is their official residence? And so I think many people will announce that before the end of the year. But we could get some of those announcements in January as well.
And we are out of time for this Monday night. Laura, always good to be with you.
Yes, it goes fast.
It goes fast. You've been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. I hope you've been listening fast. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week, we promise, with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. And between now and next week, we hope you have a great week.